Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM, Chicago. You're now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today is a special show because we are starting off the show with an interview with a group who were actually from Gary, but recorded on a few labels, including Kurtom Records in Chicago. The group is called Love's Children, and they had a name before, so we'll be going over their story. So, first of all, can you guys introduce yourselves?
Yeah, my name's Joseph Holman.
And I'm Glenn Roth.
Okay, cool. So, I guess I'll go individually on each of your backgrounds until you come together. So, Joseph, are you originally from Gary?
Born here in Chicago, but I was raised in Gary, Indiana. Yeah.
Okay. And when did you move to Gary?
I had to be about 5 years old.
Okay. And how did you first get involved with music?
Church.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's where you learn, and you're a singer, right?
Yes.
That's where you learn how to sing harmony and...
Oh, actually, I learned how to sing harmony. I had a friend when I was in junior high. Matter of fact, he's a minister now, but he taught us harmony, a guy named Robert Griffin from out of Gary, Indiana, and we actually learned in the bathroom at school.
Okay, people always talk about the echo.
Right.
So around that, what types of stuff were you singing?
A lot of Temptations, Marvelous, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, things like that.
Okay. And did you have a group together in junior high school, or you just were singing?
We were just singing. We didn't actually have a group formed, but we were the harmony guys there at Edison Grace Junior High.
So there weren't other people singing; it was just you dudes.
Yeah, it was a few around, but we were just one group that I thought that were probably better than the rest.
Okay. So
let me tell it.
When did you put a group together?
A friend of mine, he's deceased now also. We were singing, we had the same probation officer. We had got in trouble when we were kids, and
okay.
Our probation officer, Mr. Ashbury, he was a art teacher at one of the high schools in Gary, and he was also a probation officer, and he heard us sing, and he said, "I didn't know you guys could do something this constructive." And he said, let me make a few calls, and he hooked us up with Willie's mother was our first manager.
Okay. So what high school was that guy the art teacher at?
I do believe it might have been Roosevelt.
And were you in high school at the time?
Oh, at that time, no. I was still in junior high.
So who were the people that you hooked up together?
Let's see. A guy named Willie Joyce. A guy named Jimmy Clark. Robert Griffin. And... Stanley Creel.
And you.
And myself, yeah.
So there were five guys together originally.
Right.
And did you have a name?
No, we didn't have a name. We were just the harmony guys. That's what people called it.
Were you from different areas of Gary?
No, we were all there from right around the west side of Gary, around Edison Junior High.
So you all went? Did you all go to the same school?
Yes.
So when did you continue singing and eventually form a group with a name? What happened?
After we hooked up with Willie Joyce's mother, then she introduced us to. I think it was her that introduced us to Marcus, and they kind of collaborated on getting us some shows and whatnot. And we actually had gotten pretty good. Well, let Glenn tell part of it because he can tell you how he got involved.
Okay, cool. So, Glenn, are you from Gary originally?
No, I'm from Indianapolis originally. We moved to Gary in 1967. That's when we had that giant blizzard, that biggest one I've ever seen. And while I was in Indianapolis, my father was a keyboard player, and every Sunday, some of the great jazz musicians would eat at our house. My mother always fixed a big Sunday dinner, and we'd have people like Wes Montgomery, Freddie Hubbard, I mean, some of the jazz greats. Count Basie. They all would spend Sundays at our house, and I was like 4 or 5 years old. I'd sit on the stool to the Hammond B3 while my father played, and I'd watch everything he did, and that's what got me involved in it. When I moved to Gary, I was about 11 years old when I started my first group. I had a group called Glenn Soul Trio, actually.
Okay.
And we were doing a lot of Booker T and the MGs things. That's when I knew that Joe sang, but that's when they came to me and asked me if I'd like to be a part of their band. So I ended up joining up with them. And
yeah, he stayed down on the corner.
Right, I lived a block away from him, basically. And we're all from the same neighborhood. And I joined up with them. And before you know it, we were doing pretty well in the music field. I didn't have any problem out of my parents. Some of them did. They wouldn't let them go on tour and things, but I really didn't have too much of a problem because my dad was a musician, so he understood.
So you play keyboard, is that right? You learned
right.
from your dad?
That's correct.
And you did you put a band together? Well, you said you had the Grand
right,
Soul Trio. How,
right.
How did you put that band together?
It was just three guys that went to school with me, two other guys, rather, a guy named Mario Marino and a guy named James Scott. Mario played the guitar, James Scott played the bass. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And were you in high school by that time?
No, I was still kind of young, kind of about 11.
Did the Glenn Soul Trio do any shows?
Yes, we did a couple talent shows and so forth, and we only did a couple of shows because at that time, that's when I got recruited by, at that time it was the Domestics and the Domestic Four, and then when we went to Kurtom Studios is when they changed their name to the Love's Children.
So when you were the three guys, you do like Green Onion stuff.
Right,
like
right,
that.
Exactly. A Time okay. is Tight, yep, all that stuff.
So going back to the vocal group part, when did you get a name? I'm talking to Joe again. When did you get a name, and how did the group come together?
Well, we kind of hung out and sat down, and we started thinking about a name. And it was a name that somebody had already had in mind, and it was the Domestics. And the what we were going to do, we were going to wear like little short waiter jackets with tiles across our arms, and we were going to be in, and we did. We had steps like the Temptations, you know. It was real tight.
So you're saying like you were the help? But
right.
that seemed kind of far out. Was that a crazy thing to do, or was it just a unique idea for you guys?
Yeah,
or?
It was just a hook. That's all it was.
Okay. So, what were the members of the Domestics?
The original members were Willie Mitchell. I'm not Willie Mitchell. Willie Joyce, myself, Ernest Thomas, and Earl Hamer.
So there were four members.
Right.
And did you all go to the same school?
No. No, a couple of us did, and the others we got introduced to through Marcus Fairchild. He wound up as our manager.
Okay. Yeah. So you actually got hooked up with him before the Domestics came together.
Before it really came together. He's actually one of the people that helped solidify everything and us as a group and as a name.
Okay. Was he the guy that had the Domestics idea, or one of the group members did?
One of the group members did.
Which, do you remember which guy?
Not right off. That's quite a few years ago, man, and a lot of the...
But you were in high school when it happened?
Junior high.
Okay, so you were really young when it happened. About how old was everybody?
I was one of the older ones, myself and Derek Echols. We were like around the same age, and I was maybe 14 when we started, and it was like from 14 right around that area on down to Glenn. He was the youngest and the shortest.
So How so? You came up with a group named Domestics, and you, or four dudes said were singers.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get hooked up with the band?
This was also through Marcus.
Okay.
And we found Glenn and Bebe and Tim, well, Ernest Thomas, we called him Bebe. All of them, they lived right in the same neighborhood. And Marcus was aware of them, and he kind of brought it all together.
Okay, so Glenn, you ditched your old band and became part of this band.
Right.
Did you have a band name, or were you just the band for the Domestics? What was the deal?
No, we were all classified as the Domestics.
You were all the Domestics.
Right. Uh-huh.
So I had to. So that was around 67, 68, something like that?
Yeah, 68.
Yeah. So I have to ask this because you were in Gary and you were young. There had to be like the presence of the Jackson 5 somehow, right? Like, did you know them? Were they competitors? I know they were older than you probably because by 68, I think late 68 or 69, Big Boy came out.
Right.
Yeah, well, we knew of them. Like I said, I knew Jackie, Tito, and Jermaine, but I just knew them from different music functions around the city. And most bands that were in the city around that time knew each other because a lot of times the same functions had more than one band there, you know. So after a while, you know, Gary's a really small town, so it's not that hard to get to know someone.
So you actually you saw them play? Did you ever do shows with them?
No. We were slated to do a show in Detroit, but it never materialized.
Okay. So can you talk about what the shows were like? Because in Chicago, there were these big clubs like the High Chaparral. And
right.
What was the scene like in Gary, like when you did shows? Where were they and who went there and what were they like?
Oh, we did things like proms.
At theaters, was that the State or the Palace? Which one?
State or Palace
right,
Theater.
Right, the Palace right. Theater, Memorial Auditorium.
So there were some clubs, like theaters that, well, they weren't clubs, they were,
right.
They were like actually theaters where people
right.
went to see
right.
shows.
And
absolutely.
Then we played in some small clubs, bars, as a matter of fact.
Okay, yeah. So like, the theaters, would it be mostly adults or lots of kids coming to see you?
Adults.
And then obviously in the bars it
right.
was adults.
Right.
And were there also, like, what about talent shows you were talking about? Like, was there talent shows for each high school? Was there like a citywide talent show? How did
citywide.
It
Citywide.
Yeah, citywide. It was like for the best of the best.
Yeah.
So where was that and how would someone get into that and like who did you play with?
That was at most of the big talent shows were at Memorial Auditorium in
Easter
Gary.
Weekend.
Was it like once? Right. How many times did it happen a year?
Easter weekend every year.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So how did you manage to get into that talent show?
Well, you have to apply the same way you do for any talent show. And I do believe we auditioned. I can't think of where it was that we auditioned, and then we got a chance to apply.
And did it have a name, or was it just like the Gary Talent Show?
I'm not sure.
Me either, man.
But how many times did you? It was once a year. How many years did you do it?
We probably played in it, on it, in the talent show 1 year, and I think we were special guests a couple of years.
Yeah.
Okay. And by the time you were doing that, the Jackson 5 probably already went to Detroit.
Right.
Okay, so how long were you guys? Well, first of all, you were just starting high school at that time, is that right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So, how often did you practice, and where did you practice?
We practiced
four or five times a week. Yeah.
Where was it?
2661 Monroe.
Yeah.
Was that one of your houses? Or?
Yeah, the bass singer's basement. Yeah.
And were you like the main group at? Well, you didn't even all go to the same schools. What schools did you go to?
Emerson, Roosevelt, Westside.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, because most groups were all people who met in high school and went to the same school. And they're all really, at least the other Gary groups I talked to, they're all really proud of their high school. But you were all from a different school.
Right. Uh-huh.
So did you have to go far to practice every day?
Yes.
Yeah, cause like on the, Glenn and I, we stayed out on the west side of Gary, and we had to go like to the, toward the south side of downtown.
Okay. You just took the bus there?
Yeah. Or,
okay. And you must have left your organ there since you can't take that on the bus.
Well, we did take the smaller one on the organ, on the bus a couple of times, but when we first started out,
was hauling that big B3.
Right. And they get mad at me because the only thing I could carry was the stool. I was probably 70 pounds.
Did you have 4'3"?
Yeah.
You took a B3 on the bus?
No, not on the bus.
No, a truck or something?
No, in a van.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you have the Leslie speak, the spinning
speak? Yeah, Leslie. In fact, I still got a Leslie.
It's probably worth something now.
Yeah.
So how long were you together before you started doing shows? How long was the domestics together?
We were together for a few years.
But before you started doing shows, you must have been doing for a little bit.
Oh, a couple of years before we started doing shows.
And you did local shows. How often did you do shows?
Maybe 2 or 3 times a month.
Okay. And what were your shows like?
We'd sing for maybe an hour and 30 minutes sets. We would request also.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you were, like, were there sets of, did you do funk songs and soul songs? Because I know you were a harmony group, but you had a band also. Were there instrumental parts of the set? But basically, you always played with your band, is that right?
Right.
Yes.
And did you have any signature songs? Like, what types of songs would you do?
Some of the signature stuff we did was Sly and the Family Stone. Mm-hmm.
Introduction, like Walk On By Ice Case and things of that sort.
Okay, you do like the long Walk On By.
Right. We actually had a skit that we did where we would actually come out on stage. They called it Creature Features.
Right.
They had strobe lights.
Yeah.
And as you come across the stage, as the lights black out, and when they would come back on, we'd be in a different position going across the stage.
Yeah. And did you said you were still dressed like domestic, like you were like the maids or
our uniforms kind of changed. Some of it went to straight black, and the vest that we had with the fur on them.
Right. And then I remember we had dashikis one time.
Dashikis. Yeah.
That's the opposite of the domestic.
Right.
That was the picture that you were trying to scan earlier.
So the domestics, you were telling me you even had moves when you were the domestics. Mm-hmm. You even had moves that matched that. Like,
right. Oh, yeah.
Like, what was an example of something like that?
Stepping in line, turning, and spinning out, and switching across mics across in back of us while we were spinning, while the lead singer breaks down, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
So who was the lead singer?
We had a couple of lead singers. We had one, Keith Ledbetter, and Charles Simmons. He actually was Stevie Wonder's first cousin.
So the original lead singer was Keith Ledbetter.
Right. Yeah.
Did he ever record with you?
Yeah, down in Memphis. Right. Yeah.
So was that your first time you recorded?
Yeah. First time professionally.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
We were picked to be the band that that opened up for Willie Mitchell and the Memphis Review, which had the Marvelous, Willie Mitchell, Rufus Thomas. Yeah. And Rufus liked the band so much that he told Willie, "I want that band." He told us that if we could get down to Memphis, that they would record us.
Okay.
So we all piled into our bass singer's father's station wagon, head to toe, and went to Memphis.
How did you get onto that review?
We had won a talent show a couple of times, I think it was, and we were the band that they picked to open up.
Okay.
You know, it was probably some board of people that decided, but I guess we were the most impressive.
So you all drove down in a station wagon?
Yeah.
You couldn't have fit all your instruments and all the people in there? No.
The guitar players had the guitars, but
basically the U-Haul thing on top of the car.
Right. But right. As far as keyboards and everything, they had that at the studio already. Right.
Mm-hmm. So, what happened when you got down there? Like, when did you go down there, record, and drive back?
No, we stayed at a hotel down there.
The first time that we went down there, we stayed at the YMCA.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, the first time. But we went back the next time we were at a hotel.
Howard Johnson.
Right, we were performing there, and I got stuck on the elevator. Yep, got stuck in between floors.
He was crying.
So the first time you went down to Memphis, what was it like? How long was the drive?
Oh, man, I don't know, probably about 10 hours.
Yep.
That must have been rough.
Yeah.
So you got there and you checked in at the Y.
Yeah.
and did you record the next day?
Actually, as soon as we got to town, we went to Willie Mitchell's house. And actually, he came out and took some pictures because he couldn't believe how many of us were stuck in this car, you know.
So, but did you record? You didn't record that day, right?
No, I think it might have been the next day. No, it was that evening. He took us to the studio. I don't know if we recorded that day. I think he just took us and showed us everything. He was building a studio on Macklemore. He said that it used to be a restaurant, and he turned it into a studio. And he showed us like the shelves that are back here. It was like three or four rows of a wall length long of Al Green stuff that really had never been recorded. I mean, what had never been released.
So it was tapes and tapes of Al Green.
Right.
But that was just around the time Al Green was just coming out.
Right.
So what else was the High Studio? Well, was that the High Studio, or was it building a new studio? What was the deal?
That was High Records there. That was Willie Mitchell's studio there.
And I know Willie Mitchell and the High Rhythm always had like those horns and the drums you could recognize. Like, so was it really big to accommodate all? Like, what was it like there? Besides having all the tapes, do you remember anything else?
Well, it was exciting because we had never been in a big studio like that before.
Was it just one recording studio, pretty much? Or do you have multiple studios?
We did record out of stacks at one time. We went down.
Okay, so the first time you went down, what did you record?
What, Going Far Away?
Going Far Away, and let's see. I'm not sure. I think the tapes that I got at home.
It has all the recordings on it.
So those recordings, who wrote? Did you guys write your own songs? Did you do like Willie Mitchell or High people songs?
No, most of the stuff we were writing ourselves. Derek Echols, he was guitar player. He was pretty good writer, and he wrote a lot, probably maybe 85% of the material.
So what were the songs like that you did? You said it was called So Far Away. Going Far Away. And one other song you said?
It's been a long time.
One about the clock?
TikTok. Yeah, I was telling you about that.
So were those both like ballads? Was one of them funky?
Going Far Away was a kind of a funky mm-hmm. song. TikTok was a kind of a ballad.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And almost everything that High released had Willie Mitchell's band on it. Was your band playing?
No, it was our band that played.
Yeah.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because you can always tell the drums have a certain sound.
Philadelphia sound.
Yeah. There's definitely you could tell any Willie Mitchell related recording. So you recorded, and then what happened? Did it get released?
No, it didn't get released. There was some business things that went on between our manager and the record company, and we decided to go into another direction.
Okay, so you cut two records for High, but they were never came
right,
out.
Right.
And then you went back to Gary and continued to do what you were doing.
Right.
And you were still in high school at that time, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
You were still just early in high school, pretty much?
I was in 10th grade.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we actually went up to Detroit and auditioned for Motown.
But you said you also went to Stax. Did you do that before Motown?
That was before. We were still doing the Memphis thing then.
Right.
How many times did you go to Memphis?
Three times, yeah.
Were they all hooked up by your manager?
All that was all hooked up through our manager and Willie Mitchell and Rufus.
Okay. And so the first time you went to the High Studios, did you go to High the second time?
Yeah.
Did you record anything else?
Yeah. But
I know you don't remember the songs.
Yeah, right.
You remember you recorded like two more songs the second time?
Yeah.
How long in between the first visit, like how many months after the first visit did you go the second time?
It wasn't too far.
It wasn't that long.
It wasn't too long, maybe 3 weeks to a month or so.
So at that time, High still, that you still thought you were going to get stuff put out.
Right, right.
I think you told me you were recording a whole album there?
Right, that was our intention, yeah.
Right.
And so did you cut an album's worth of material?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
But it's just never released.
Right.
That's what I got.
I bet it's pretty excellent.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We had TikTok, Confusion.
Yep.
I try to think of it, and then I black out.
You definitely need to get, we didn't need to get those tapes from this.
Right, right.
But who was the producer of the album?
Willie Mitchell produced those.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
But you ended up with the tapes? You got dubs or something?
Well, what happened was the guitar player, Rick, I don't know how he ended up with them, and then he passed, and his nephew left them with me.
Well,
them over to me, yep.
It's great that you still have the material, because
right.
There's so much lost recorded material.
Right, right, right.
So you said the third time you went to Memphis, you recorded at the Stax Studio.
Yeah, yeah.
How did was that also hooked up to Willie Mitchell?
Yep. And it was really something, because when they took us down there, they took us down and took us to the rear of the building. We saw Isaac Hayes' Cadillac. It was green with the bumpers and the rims were gold. We were stretched all out on it, taking pictures and stuff, you know. And then they took us into the back of the of Stax downstairs. That's where the studio was, and recorded a couple of songs. I can't recall which ones they were.
But do you have tapes of those too?
No, I just got the ones from the High Studio.
I wonder why Willie Mitchell would have taken you to Stax.
So. Well, the way I understood is that all of them were hooked up together in some fashion.
Okay. Were the Stax Studios huge? Like, was it really big?
No, it wasn't that big a studio. It was in a building that looked like a movie theater, but it was around downstairs in the back.
Okay. Yeah, I know that's a famous, there's a famous picture of the studio. Mm-hmm. I know what that looks like. So, did you do any shows when you were in Memphis?
No, we tried, but there was, back in those days, there was a really strict ordinance of minors performing in clubs and bars.
Like the opposite of Chicago.
Right.
You could be 6 years old.
Right.
Well,
right.
Like Stevie Wonder. That was a Regal, but I'm sure the Jackson 5 were playing very adult clubs.
Right.
So you recorded a whole bunch of tracks in Memphis. Nothing really happened with them because of contract type, business type stuff.
Right.
Were you mad or annoyed?
No, we knew something else was going to come our way. And just a matter of sitting back, and we kept learning writing new material and so forth. And it ended up, where did we end up next? We went to Detroit.
We went to Detroit and auditioned.
To Motown. Yeah.
So you still kept the same lineup?
Well, when we got to Detroit, being that Stevie was Chucky's cousin.
Well, was he? That's Charles Simmons?
Charles Simmons, right. Uh-huh.
Had he joined? So when did the lead singer change?
Oh, that's when Pee-wee left.
Right.
When Keith Lee.
His voice started changing and so forth.
And he smoked cigarettes.
Right, right.
So, a little short guy.
He ended up no longer with us, and we ended up getting Charles Simmons. And
how did you find Charles?
The manager did, Marcus Fairchild, and
he also lived in Gary, though.
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So we got Charles, and then we found out Charles was Stevie's cousin, and so forth. And Stevie wanted to hear us, and
he was Stevie's first cousin.
Right.
Yes, Stevie's his mother and Stevie's mother sisters.
Right.
And when he. Did Stevie Wonder, like, see you in Gary perform, or what happened?
Well, we
didn't see you.
Right.
Yeah, I was going to laugh about that.
We actually did
a show with Stevie in Gary. Gary.
Right, that's after we recorded up there first.
Right, right.
And when we went to Motown, Stevie actually wrote a song for us.
Yeah, I was telling him, Motown. I'm going to tell you about the way I feel.
Yeah, you make me feel so good. And
you make
real
me
nice,
feel
funky
so
song.
Good.
And when we were in the studio, who was that? We ran into David Ruffin.
Yeah,
David
we were in the bathroom
right.
just going over some songs, you know,
right.
and we were trying to figure out a part to put into this song. And there was a guy at the sink washing his hands. We were in the men's room. And he said, why don't you try this? And he did a little riff, and he put on the glasses, and it was David.
Yeah. You knew from the glasses.
They were glasses. Yeah. It was David Ruffin.
Absolutely, yeah.
Was that, was that after he went solo? Because I know it was around that time.
Yeah, he was solo.
So Dennis Edwards and
Ruffin. Right.
So that's pretty awesome story.
Yeah.
He finished the riff of the song.
Right.
So do you remember what year you went down to Motown?
That had to be, what?
70, 71.
70, early, yeah, and that was 70. It had to be 70.
Mm-hmm. And you drove the same van?
We rented a van. I think Temp drove us.
Yeah, the Volkswagen Temp. Van.
Yeah. We had a guy named Temp that used to drive for us, and he drove us up in the van. Never forget, as soon as we got in front of Stevie's house, we pull up in the driveway. Here comes this big, giant dog. Now, seven or eight of us, and I'm the one in the front. Everybody's holding everybody. Joe's got me, and then whoever's behind. He's got a giant dog, man. The dog comes up and puts his paws on my shoulder. I thought I was going to have a heart attack. But
he loved him to death.
He didn't bite me, though. But, yeah, we had a real good time up there at Stevie's place.
And you said you had done a show with Stevie before you went there?
No, this was after.
So initially you went to Stevie's house.
Right.
Right.
What was his house like?
Oh, it was nice. He had a real nice basement with all the keyboards and everything. It was set up real nice down there for
the
years and stuff.
We actually seen the clavinado that he patented.
We actually seen...
It was in the making. It was sitting on the dining room table.
Right. Also, I saw my first ARP 2600 there. And,
Yeah,
with all the patch cords and so forth.
Had you even, like, heard this synth before?
I heard synth, but I had never seen all this stuff.
And, yeah. Did he live in a big house?
It wasn't real, real big at that time, but it was a nice house.
Nice big house, like for a big family. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And it tripped me out. We were down in the basement, and something happened, and I guess we blew a fuse or something, and Steve said, what happened to the damn lights? And that blew me away. You can tell light from dark. You can tell light from dark and so forth. And I was wondering about that. I said, wow. Yeah, but then after he heard us then when we came back to Gary and so forth, he was coming to Gary to do a show within the next couple of months anyway.
Right.
So he put us on that show with him and so forth at West Side High in Gary. And
Stevie played at high school.
Right, Stevie played at the high school, yep.
Who else was on the show?
Just us and Stevie.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Yep. And
he was in the gymnasium, so it was packed, needless to say.
So did you stay overnight at Stevie's house?
No, we stayed at a motel.
You just got to hang out there.
Right. Yep.
Then we went down to the audition hall the next day, and we auditioned for some people. We did quite a few songs, and one guy, he turned to walk out, and my manager said, we got more songs. We got choreography, too. And he said, I've heard what I wanted to hear, and he told the guy to take us out to Studio B.
So, but Berry Gordy wasn't one of the people in the hall.
No, it wasn't him. No, I know
it was just some talent agents for Motown.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
But Stevie wasn't enough to be like record these dudes. Like,
this was the one thing about it is, you know, Stevie had enough clout there that we were on.
Right, but it was going to take so long before anything was put out. I mean, we were at the point we wanted to get something out, and we wanted to get it out within 6 months. And it wasn't going to happen there. So,
because Motown had a bazillion things to work with.
So
you went there, and you said you went to Studio B. And was it huge? What were the Motown studios like?
That was a huge studio.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was in the old Motown house, though. It's the house.
Okay.
Hitsville, the big sign up on in front of it and everything.
But so you recorded two songs there?
Yeah, I'm gonna move up to a higher class. Yeah. And then the one that Stevie wrote for
us. Make me feel so good.
Mm-hmm. And how long were you in Detroit in that visit?
As a matter of fact, we didn't stay long. We turned around and went back to Gary, and I guess they were gonna have a press party so the moguls could listen to the demos. And whatnot. Then we went.
I think he was getting ready to get married at that time.
Right.
That's when he was right around when he was getting ready to get married to Sarita.
I'm not that Sarita. Deep. Like, yeah. I don't know that date. But it was actually your band played with the group. It wasn't like the Funk Brothers or anything.
No. We did all our own stuff. Yep.
So. And were you billed as, like, the Domestics or the Domestic Four with the Domestics? What was your name?
Well, we actually, being in that business for a little while, we got kind of smart because if we went with the name the Domestic Four and had to make an appearance maybe on TV or something, then they would only want to see the Four. So we changed it back to the Domestics so the whole band could be wherever we went that the whole band would... would go on.
Yeah, I saw the photo you showed me, and it's clearly like focused on the whole group. It was like a psychedelic looking photo. It was around 1970 when all this stuff was happening. Kind of like a Sly Stone photo or something like that. So you were called, so you recorded the songs, and then you went back to Gary, and you were again still in high school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you think you were going to be big stars? Because obviously you weren't in... There's a lot of people who are in the industry for 10 years get really bitter.
I thought it was on. With Stevie behind us. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, when we came out of the men's room and went in and started recording, Gladys Knight was in the sound booth, and there was a couple of other entertainers in there, and they put their endorsements on the demos also.
And but you weren't viewed as like a kind of kiddie bubblegum group. Like, you were more like an adult type group. Like, you weren't the Jackson 5.
Right, no, we weren't the Jackson 5. And this was one of the things that went along with the demo. That was another thing about being a Domestic Four. It sounded too much like the Jackson 5. And the song that we recorded, they said, well, that's good. But the song kind of sounded a lot like something that the Temptations would. But they were very much interested in, you know, in signing us at that time.
So, but you didn't have a contract before you recorded. You just went and recorded.
Right.
So what happened with that recording? It just sat there like many other things at Motown?
Right.
Yep.
Right.
Did you ever sign a contract with them?
No.
Just probably due to managerial or personal things?
Right. Our manager, he was somewhat of a power hound, and sometimes when you have us being minors, and when you have older people, you know, grown-ups that were running the business, a lot of times you weren't part of the decision making.
Okay. Like you were really young at that time. So you went back to Gary. You must have been frustrated that
there's stuff really. We were about to break up. And my brother and a band, the call wheel, they were called the Enterprise, and the girls were called the Teak.
The
Teaks, who were the group that recorded.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And they put us on the bill to draw people out to see that band, to see that show. And the second night after the first set, we went to the dressing room, and Curtis Mayfield and his bass player were standing there. In the dressing room, said Lucky Scott. Yeah.
Okay.
And he said, "I've been hearing about you guys, and I really have been trying to catch your act. And we want to get together and bring you over so Eddie Thomas can hear you."
So that was actually, you were just going to break up after that show, and then
we were on the verge of breaking up because we had been through so much, And those were two big letdowns with Memphis and then Motown.
Yeah.
So everybody had really, it was a lot of distension in that.
So, and then Curtis was like, "We want to sign you."
Right.
And what happened? Did you go to Curtom Records, sign a contract? What happened?
Yeah, we went in and we sung for Eddie Thomas. And he was blown away. Some of his writers were there. He said, "Man, I've been looking for material like this for years. And here are these guys walking off the street with it." And so they said, Curtis said, "Well, I got a few songs for you," and blah, blah. And they signed the contracts. And actually, my parents didn't, my mother didn't want me to sing, not because it was music back then.
It was secular.
Right. And she was a church woman. But the thing about it is, though, that she didn't want me going behind her back and doing something. So she gave me her blessing. And her and my father went ahead and signed my signature on the contract.
Okay, cool. Well, we've been talking for a long time now. And you recorded more, but there were three recordings released on Curtom. So I want to play one of them so we can talk some more. Soul is Love is the first record I'm going to play.
Okay.
So this, and we haven't gotten to it yet, but this is The Love Children with Soul is Love.
Come and sing the monkeys, all the same as the
Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM Chicago. If you're just tuning in, we're doing an interview with members of a Gary group who were known as the Domestics and who recorded as the Love's Children. So that was the Love's Children first release called Soul is Love. So we were just talking about how Curtis Mayfield and Lucky Scott saw you guys backstage at one of your last shows that you had planned to do. So they signed you. Did they sign the band and the vocal group, or what happened?
But they actually signed the vocal group.
Okay. So I'll get to what happened with Glenn after that. But did you try to get them to sign the band, or what happened?
Well, it was a package deal in the way that it went.
Okay.
And like I say, we weren't actually upfront in the decision-making process. So a lot of things were done without, you know, our input.
You originally wanted to stay together.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting because I had heard that Kurt Tom had the option of signing the Jackson 5 before they went to Motown, and I had heard that they were like, oh, well, we already have a kiddie group, the Stair Steps, and that they probably regretted it.
Oh, right. I think so.
Because the Stair Steps had a different sound. They were more sophisticated soul. And that Soul is Love song definitely had like more of like the Jackson 5 bubblegum kind of song. So maybe they intended for you to be their competition or to the Jackson 5, something like that. So do you remember, so originally you thought the whole band and the group were going to sign.
Right.
And then it ended up being just the group. How did you get the names Love's Children?
Like I say, the name was pulled out of a hat. It was a few names in there, but I know was it his daughter? He called her his love child.
You're talking about Curtis's daughter?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he called her his love child, and that's where the name Love Children came from. So that name was in the hat, so that's the one that got pulled. I don't know what the other names was in the hat.
So you just kind of just picked out your name.
Right.
That was your name. Yeah. So, yeah, and it's interesting because the flip side, This is the End. Well, both sides are written by Curtis.
Yes.
And This is the End is a much more kind of sophisticated, stair-step sounding song. So it's like they wanted to get both. Both things. I wanted like a pop hit and a soulish side. So did the group kind of break up when that happened, or like Love's Children just stayed together?
Oh, and no, we stayed together. Yeah.
So the Domestics were the Domestics,
right?
Still all the same.
But Love's Children happened to get a contract with with Kurt Tom.
Right.
So do you remember going to Chicago to record?
Oh yeah, we recorded at RCA Studios on One Wacker Drive, all the way upstairs.
So did Kurt Tom have their own studios at that time?
I don't know, but I know that that's where all the recording went on up there. We were there for quite a few hours, and the thing about it is that while we were there, it just so happened Diana Ross was there recording I'm Coming Out while we were there.
Okay.
And that was exciting.
Yeah. So how long, like, did you have multiple interactions with Kurt Tom and Curtis and Eddie Thomas before you recorded?
Yes, because every time the Impressions or whatever would do a show, we would be there and we would play. I mean, and at that time it was our original band and everything.
So the Domestics started to do shows with the Impressions.
Right. Every place that they played at, we were there with them.
In Chicago. So had you done many shows in Chicago before, or that's when you really started doing shows in Chicago?
We did a few, but
that's when it really started jumping out. Yep.
And were you still in high school too, or were you just okay?
Uh-huh.
So, what are some of the clubs you did? You mentioned the High Chaparral already.
High Chaparral, Guys and Gals,
Burning Spear,
Bill Street Club,
Purrs. What was it?
Purbs House.
Right, Purbs House, yeah.
Skyway Lounge that Don Cornelius had. Tiger Lounge on the west side.
Right, the big hotels. I think we're at the Hilton, several places. Right.
And you were billed as the Domestics. Did your band play for the Impressions, or they had their own band?
No, they had their own band. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I remember, actually, their band for a while was the Winstons, actually, before they did Color and Father. But anyways, so do you remember some of the other people on the shows, or it was just mainly you and the Impressions?
Ruby Andrews. Yeah, It's All Over Casanova. Jody Gales. Five Stair Steps. Who else, man? Help me out. He's a lot younger than I am.
I guess it's really because Jody had a push and pull record, and in that song you're talking about pushing and pulling at the same time.
Right.
So how long did you go about? Did you do it on the weekends because you were still in school?
Yeah, like, most of the time the shows were on the weekends.
But you were at adult clubs at that point.
Yeah.
And do you have any exciting stories about doing shows in Chicago?
Oh, yeah.
Well, stories you want to tell on the radio.
We actually did a show at the High Chaparral, and the MC there, I can't think what his name was, somebody threw some change up on the stage. And the MC told him, I say, what are you throwing these nickels and dimes up there? These boys are dynamite. They do all types of music here, and these boys, they deserve a lot more respect than that. And they called us back down from the dressing room and made us walk through the crowd, and the people gave us money in our hands.
That's awesome. So you were still the Domestics, that was still your look too, or you had gone?
No, we were Love Children then.
Okay, so but you performed as Love Children with your whole...
Right.
Did you have a specific look, or you were just all psychedelic, like in the
most
photo?
Times psychedelic, yeah. And
they did have uniforms.
Yeah, we had a couple of uniforms.
They did take us out, and
but it was like nice performers' uniforms. Right, it wasn't like a theme or anything.
No.
So, how long did you do shows together as Love's Children?
Actually, we did shows together as Love's Children all the way to the end.
Okay, which was. When was the end? Like 72?
72, yeah.
So that record, Soul is Love, came out. Did it get any play?
Oh, yeah.
It was a big record?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
We went down to Columbus, Ohio. It was on the Billboard charts. It was towards the top. I mean, within the top 50. Yep. And we were signing autographs.
Oh yeah,
it was unbelievable.
You should see my signature. It looks like a doctor's signature, but that's where it comes from, because we used to sign autographs so fast, so many autographs.
And we'd be at the radio station; they'd have 9 phones up there. We're all on the phone talking to people, and it was a great experience, man.
So the whole band would crowd into the radio station.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And Kurt Bishop was the DJ,
right? WVKO,
absolutely.
And actually. This is the End and Soul is Love. They flip-flopped a cup for a while as number one and number two.
Yeah, This is the End. Well, I just don't want to run out of time in the interview, but let's play This is the End because it's a good song. So this is the Love Children with the B-side of Soul is Love. This track is called This is the End. Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM Chicago. This is the Sitting in the Park show. If you're just tuning in, that was The Love's Children with This is the End. And we have members of Love's Children in the studio. That was the flip side of your first single that Kurtom Records mm-hmm. put out. And you were saying that that side actually got some play too.
Right.
And, they actually issued a second single, and on the second single, they put that on the A side, and they put a song called Why Should I Stay on the flip. So, first of all, do you remember how many songs you recorded at Kurtom? Did you record anything that was not released, or just recorded those three songs?
Those were the ones that we recorded, because those were the ones that Curtis had, written for us, and that's what most of the time when we made it to the studio, the music had already been done.
Oh, the tracks had been laid uh-huh. down. Yeah, and Curtis wrote all three sides mm-hmm. that were released. And it's interesting because on that side, you sound like the Stair Steps sounded around that time, mm-hmm. and on the A side, you sounded kind of Jackson-y, so you were very versatile in mm-hmm. the group. So you said you did an actual show. You did a show in Ohio. You were telling me, what was the show like?
We went down there. Soldiers Love and This is the End had done very well in Ohio, and we were in Columbus. And actually, the two songs were number one and number two, and then they flipped. A DJ Kirk Bishop from WVKO Radio. And Columbus brought us in, and we thought about it, nothing about it at the time. But the band that was opening up for us was the Ohio Players. They were a local band at the time.
Yeah, they didn't have a big hit by then yet. You were out before they.
Right.
I'm trying to think what their first big hit.
Pain,
probably. Yeah.
Right.
So like you, yeah, that was 72, I think, or 73. So you were out before that.
Right.
So they were nobodies, and you were the band. You were
the big guy.
Right. Did you do tours anywhere else? Play any shows anywhere else besides Columbus?
We went across the country.
Yeah, we could.
And we played at a lot of penal institutions.
Okay.
Because they didn't get a lot of R&B acts and stuff like that being jail. You know, and we played Ohio.
All the way to Kearney, Nebraska.
Kearney, Nebraska, Worland, Wyoming.
Yep.
And you had the same manager that hooked it up, or was Kurtom managing you at that time?
He's the one that hooked that up.
Yeah.
That sounds like a good circuit. Like, you got automatically people excited and like, I haven't heard really of actually groups doing that circuit. I know the Moments have, like, a record, like, at a women's prison where all the women are screaming. But, like, what was the reception like at the prisons?
Ooh, man.
A lot of women screaming
and whistling. So
you did women's prisons?
Yeah.
Were they all women's prisons?
We did one in Lancaster, Ohio.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty funny. Yeah. Must have been like your best reception.
Oh man, they loved this, man.
And you said you went farther west.
We went to we played in Kearney, Nebraska,
Warland,
Wyoming.
Okay, that's pretty far west.
Yeah,
you went. So, and you all drove around in like a rented van, or
right?
Yeah, we went around.
Okay, and so Kurtom released another record on you. This is the end, and why should I stay? But I know that record is really rare, so it probably didn't get distributed or played. So what happened after that? Did you continue to play together? Did you sign to another label? What was the story?
At that time, individuals in the band were getting older, and some were leaving the way to school. Some were joining the service, and some, like myself, were still in school, and I looked at it as they all deserted me, kid you. But it ended up, I still continued to play. And but we always kept in contact for the most part, except for Charles Simmons, which my brother finally contacted him for us after about how long?
Oh, man.
35, 40 years. Yeah. We hadn't heard from this guy.
Is he still in Gary?
He's in
Tacoma, Washington.
Right.
So your story kind of splits at that point. Uh-huh. So Glenn, but you were both still living in Gary, is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Glenn, what did you do after Love Children split up?
Well, I played with a couple of other groups. I was with the Realistics for a while.
You were like their backing band?
Yes, I was. I was a keyboard player for the Realistics.
Okay.
Yep, and let's see, who else did I play? I play with a group called Ultra High Frequency, UHF.
They did We're on the Right, the group that did We're on the Right Track. There was an Ultra High Frequency that recorded, and I think they were from Chicago.
Okay, no, these guys were from Gary.
But did you record?
No, I never recorded. I had just moved back from Indianapolis, and my drummer, he asked me to come join up with them, and I joined up with them, and within 2 weeks we were doing a thing called Uptown in the Park, where there was a Sheik, Ashford and Simpson, Roy Ayers, and Tavares were there. And
around what? So that was like 76, 75, 76?
Probably. No, that had to be in the 80s. That had to be in the
80s. You didn't know if they recorded before?
No. They weren't together in the 70s.
Okay. Because there was a group from... I heard Danny Johnson of the Shylights later was their lead, but...
Okay.
I'm not sure. I heard that from someone. But there was a group called Ultra High Frequency that went to Philly and recorded in Philly. Yeah. But you were in the 80s, you remember.
Right.
Were you in any other groups?
Just one I'm in now. I mean, Midnight Crisis.
Okay.
Midnight Crisis.
When did that group form?
About a year ago. We've been together since then.
And what kind of group are you? And what
we do rhythm and blues. We do blues. We do oldies but goodies. Right now, we haven't put out anything of our own yet. We've just been doing cover tunes like Natalie Cole, Aretha Franklin, B.B. King, Albert, Bobby, Blue Bland. Do a lot of things of that sort.
And who are the members of Midnight Crisis?
We got Jacqueline Ayers, we got Tommy Shorter, Stephen Campbell, Rodney Evans, Nick Boyd, Danny Cruz. I think that's about it.
And one thing I think I completely neglected, which is bad, is we went over the singers of Love's Children. Who were the band members and what did each member play?
It was Donald Anderson. He played the bass guitar. Timothy Long played the drums. Michael Anderson played lead and rhythm. Derek Eccles played lead and rhythm.
And myself
on the keyboard. Glenn Roth.
Okay. And did that lineup stay the same? Pretty much throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Love Children and the Domestics, pretty much almost the only change was the lead singer.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. What was the first one? Was Keith Ledbetter.
Uh-huh.
And the second one was Charles Simmons.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So, Joe, did you continue to do music after Love's Children broke up?
Not right away. I graduated high school, and I actually had to get a job. I got a job in the steel mill, and I worked there a year, and then I went to the Marines. After I got out of the Marine Corps, I had some personal demons that took over my life for a while, but I moved up to Milwaukee, and I met a guy named Marvelous Mac.
When did you move to Milwaukee?
1986.
Okay.
And they were actually singing, and I just joined in. And myself, him, and his cousin, we actually would do a cappella at clubs. And they'd put money in a hat on the floor. And Mac is the one that put the band together, and I sang with him for quite a few years. And
What was your band called?
Marvelous Mac and the Pressure Release.
Okay.
Band. A couple of years ago, I went to an open jam in Milwaukee, and I met a guy named J.D. Optikar. He's a guitar player. He's quite a good writer. He approached me, told me he liked my sound and would I be interested in the project that he had, that he was trying to put together. And I said, yeah, I'll give it a try. And the clique that we had, him, myself, a guy named Donnie Mack, and Marcus Gibbons was a drummer. We kind of just clicked, and it went from a ball of clay to a statue that was great.
Okay, so you were a fully formed band,
right?
So, what was the name of your band?
Tweed Funk.
Who came up with that name?
We put some names in the hat. JD has a couple of names, and that was his choice. And it was because we were kind of funky, and we had some older guys in the band, you know. And
I don't know what you're talking about.
So the name stuck, and it's become a household name in a lot of places.
Okay, I want to play something from each of your bands. Glenn, I already forgot the name of your current band. What are they called?
Midnight Crisis.
Is there a specific track you want me to play?
Play track 3.
Okay, here. What's this called?
Let's see. I'm not sure. This is a song called Love Changes.
Okay, so this is Midnight Crisis with Love Changes.
Must be love.
Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM, Chicago. That was actually really nice. That was a track by a group called Midnight Crisis, and the track was called Love Changes. And that group featured Glenn Ross, who was in the studio, who was a member of the Domestics and Love Children. So that was just like a demo you did, right? How many songs did you record?
Just four on that, just...
That had a really nice sound, though. It didn't, because like a lot of stuff people do now have like really cheesy synthesizer, and that had like a real. It sounded almost 80s, but had a really nice sound. And the guitar was real Isley-ish. I was telling you. So, and do the other songs sound similar?
Well, on that I got a song that I did by Chaka Khan, and then we've got a couple of blues songs on there too, featuring the gentleman Nick Boyd, featuring him.
So who's the woman singing lead on the
song? That's Jacqueline Ayers.
Okay. And you were telling me that the guitar player who was in the Gary group Ripples in the Waves,
right,
the records in your band.
Yeah, that's Stephen Campbell from the Ripples in the Waves. That was him doing the solo on that song there.
Okay, cool. Yeah, the Isley's solo.
Right.
That was cool. But that's not officially released, but are you starting to do shows?
Yeah, we're doing shows, huh?
Where have you been playing around Gary? Have you done shows in Chicago?
Just around Gary, and we've been on the casino boats. We do the casinos and things.
Okay, cool. How often do you do shows?
Probably at least a couple times a month.
Okay. Yeah, I hope something comes of that, too. And I'll play the song for whoever I can.
Okay, appreciate it.
You were with a band. Are you still with a band called Tweed Funk?
Yes, I'm the lead singer.
Okay.
Actually, I'm. Yeah.
And you have two full CDs here.
Uh-huh.
And you're a Milwaukee group.
Right.
So, what year did you form? Because the CDs are from 2011 and 2012.
We formed in 2010.
Okay, and you originally did shows around Milwaukee.
We actually did a little Midwest tour, and we went to and wound up in Houston. We did BB Jazz Blues and Soups in St. Louis. We left there, went to Indianola, Mississippi, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Houston, Jefferson City, Missouri, and Fort Smith, Arkansas, and the Pekin, Illinois.
And what were the shows like? Were you like bluesish? Did you do like funk, like retro R&B style? Like
we did R&B, funk, and blues. This is what we were all about.
Okay, and so the CD you did from 2011 is called "Bringing It."
Yes.
And then the one you did from 2012 is called Love Is.
Yes.
So I have queued right now a track from Love Is. I think this track is called Dance Maker. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so this is Tweed Funk with Dance Maker.
Do you know what I mean? I'm a dancing machine.
Tweed Funk off of their newest CD that was called Dance Maker. Well, it's called Dance Maker. It's playing right now, so you could get an idea of what they sound like. You were telling me, Joe, that you had a video on YouTube from one of the songs?
Yes, for Fine Wine.
Okay, cool. So is that song representative of what you sound like? Do you do ballads also?
It was actually a song that was geared toward, like... women as they age and they get better with time.
Oh, that's the Fine Wine song.
Right.
But in your, you do all kinds of different material, right?
Right?
Yeah. Are you oriented towards like the blues circuit? Is that a lot of your show?
Yeah.
Okay. So I wanted to ask, do you have any shows coming up?
Oh, yes. Well, as a matter of fact, we have one coming up here in Chicago at Legends. At Buddy Guy's Club, Legends. We opened up for him at Purdue University back in October, and he asked us to come play in his club, and we'll be there on the 14th of March.
Okay, cool. So people should definitely go.
Oh yeah,
to check your band Tweed Funk out.
Oh yeah, most definitely.
And can they just find the CDs online? Are they easy to find?
Yeah, iTunes, CD Baby.
Okay.
Or www.tweedfunk.com. Go to the merchandising section and we'll shoot one out to you.
Okay. And
two or five, or however many you need.
And Midnight Crisis, do you have any shows coming up?
No, right now we're redoing everything. We're putting a whole new show together at this time. So it'll probably be at least another month before we go back out.
Okay, but people should definitely look out for you.
Oh, yeah, look out for us.
Yeah. So... I gotta say, thanks so much for coming down. You guys had an awesome story.
Yeah.
Like, lots of times, the groups that cut one record, you know, have the most interesting story.
Yeah.
And the groups that cut 40 records don't remember anymore.
Right.
So, you guys, thanks again. It was an excellent story. Do you have any last words for the listening audience?
Nope.
Just check out your music.
Just check us out.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Check out Tweed Funk. We are HHHOOOTTT hot. Check us out. You will enjoy our show. When you leave our show, you will be mesmerized and tingling.
Okay.
Thank you.
Awesome. So, thanks again. And this last record that I'm going to play is the rare B-side of the second Love's Children record. And this is a really good record, actually. This track is called Why Should I Stay?